So we are in the 11th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, which is a very beautiful chapter, which is called the Cosmic Form, Vishwarup Sandarshana Yoga, the Cosmic Form. So there the Lord shows Arjuna and shows all of us through the pen of Ved Vyasa, the author of the Bhagavad Gita, the divine form of the Lord, how wonderful it is and how large it is and how the whole universe is included in that one form. It's a very beautiful picturization. I'm not going very much detail because there is some repetition, but I would request every one of you to read this chapter in detail. So anyway, so in this chapter, what we are seeing is that there is a battle going on, which is here you can see the battlefield. And that the Pandavas are the good and the Kauravas are the evil. And Krishna and Arjuna, Krishna is the Lord and Arjuna is the student. And the Bhagavad Gita is taught by the Lord to Arjuna. And here, of course, we see him in his divine form. But actually, he was the driver. He was the chauffeur driving Arjuna's chariot. The implication being that if you give your chariot to the Lord, if you give your life to the Lord, then he takes you everywhere. And that is the symbolism of that. And that is what we have to practice, that, oh Lord, you are the one doing everything. My boat, I have to cross this ocean of this world with all its storms and problems. And if I give my boat to you and you become the boatman, you drive my boat and take it across the ocean. And no matter how many problems come, as the ocean has all kind of storms and all kind of difficulties, if the Lord is my boatman, then I have nothing to worry about. So here also, Arjuna gives his chariot and makes the Lord his driver. So the Lord actually plays the part of a chauffeur in this particular episode of the Mahabharata. And so the Lord is showing Arjuna his divine form. On Arjuna's request, Arjuna says, I would like to see your divine form, how you pervade the whole universe and how the whole universe is in you. You tell me that you are the all-pervading reality and the whole universe. And the universe extends for trillions of miles. And not only that, that is only the visible universe that we see. There are so many large worlds above the heavens, which are not visible to us. There are the lower planes of what we call as hells, where all the ghosts and goblins and demons. And so all these 14 worlds are encompassed by the Lord and he extends beyond. So that is the form that we see in the 11th chapter. And then at the palace, as we have seen, Dhritarashtra, who was the father of the Kauravas, was blind, was not able to see the battle. So his minister, Sanjay, who had the divine vision where he could see what was happening in the battlefield more than 20 miles away. So these are the three characters in this particular play that we are watching. And we have already seen last week how the Lord showed his form to Arjuna and he gave him a Divya Drishti, a special vision where he could see the entire universe in that one little form, you know, the form of the Lord. He's only, whatever, you know, 6 feet or whatever his height and width was, but he could see the entire universe, all the worlds and all the gods and even the demons and goblins, everything. Not only that, but he could see the past, present and future. He could see what has happened. He could see himself and the whole battlefield in the Lord, and then he could see the future, what is going to happen, and that's what we'll be covering in the next few weeks. So we'll do the 18th verse again. The 18th verse, I had done the first to describe the Lord's characteristics. What are the Lord's qualities as described by Arjuna? Arjuna describes the Lord's qualities in the 18th verse. And we have done the first two last week. We'll do the other six today. So in the 18th verse, Tvamaksharam paramam veditavyam. Tvamasya vishvasya param nidhanam. Tvam avyaya shashvata dharma gopta. सनातनस्त्वं पुरुषो मतो मे So these are the qualities we talked about last week. He is the indestructible, aksharam. Indestructible, like the mud is indestructible. The parts may be created out of mud. The parts may get destroyed, but the mud remains the same. Even when the part is there and when the part is not there, nothing happens to the mud. So the Lord is the substratum of the whole universe and the highest thing to be known. We are all the time wanting to know worldly things, you know, what is happening in Africa, what is happening in Iraq, what is happening in India, what is happening in the rest of the US, but we don't try to know who I am. And they say, I am a manifestation of that Lord, that divinity, and we don't ever try to know who the Lord is. Or at the most, if we know him, we know him, okay, you know, he's there somewhere in the temple and church, and we go once a week and bow down and light a candle, and we say we are done. But that is not to be known. Do you have to know him as your own true self? Then the third one we are going to do today is Tvamasya Vishvasya Param Nidhanam. Of this world, you are the highest wealth. Of this world, you are the highest wealth. Now the word Vishva is the world. What we think of the world as, okay, this visible world, this trees and plants and Bakersfield and US and Canada and Mars and Venus. But Swami Chinmayananda in his commentary said, Vishwa does not only mean the visible world that we can see, hear, smell, taste and touch, but also the emotional world. You know, because we have so many emotions. I have emotions of joy and sorrow and anger and hatred, and my emotions interact with others' emotions. So the world of emotions, and with the intellect, the world of thoughts. So all the objects of the world that I see, hear, smell, taste, and touch, all the emotional world, because we deal with emotions, and also the thoughts and concepts. So the intellectual world of thoughts and concepts and ideas and science and mathematics, all that constitutes Vishwa. So everything that I can see, that I can feel, and I can think constitutes Vishwa. So he is the Param Nidhanam. He is the highest wealth. He is the storehouse of wealth. And there is a beautiful story. There was this wedding going on, and in India, especially in the olden days, it now still happens, but in the olden days, weddings would go on for a whole week. And what they would do is the bride's house, you know, the groom's party would come to the bride's house and stay for 3-4 days and have all these ceremonies. And the bride's party had to set up ahead of time to welcome all the groom and, you know, 200 or 300 guests. So they would rent, you know, maybe a hotel or a dharamshala or some home so that they could accommodate these people. And the preparations would start months ahead, and they would prepare some of the foods and all that. And so the mithai or the sweets are the very integral part of the wedding. And so in this particular wedding, they had prepared lots of sweets. And, you know, these last for days. So they had made a cupboard and they had locked it up because the children obviously want sweets all the time. And there is usually an uncle, a senior uncle, who is in charge of the wedding. In my case, it was my mother's Puaji, you know, her uncle, who was in charge of all the weddings anywhere in the family. So this uncle is given the key that, you know, to make sure that the cupboard where the sweets are kept is locked. And when the children come, you give them a little bit at a time. Otherwise, they'll finish all the sweets. So the children would come, uncle, uncle, please give us some sweets. So he would open the cupboard, give each one 2 sweets, and then they would go away. And then 3-4 hours later, again, uncle, uncle, we want. So again, he would do that. And so that went on for a couple of days. Now, there was one little girl who would just stand quietly and not ask for anything, not ask for the sweet. She wouldn't even take it. And the uncle was surprised. Everybody else is grabbing and give me that. And she's standing quietly on one side. So then finally he asked her, he says, don't you want the sweets? She says, no. So he said, then why are you here? She said, I want the key. That way, when I have the key, then I can get the sweets anytime I want, you know, whenever I want. And that is the essence, because the Lord is the key. He is the highest wealth. what we do is we search for tiny, like those little kids begging for sweets. So we are begging for little pleasures. Give me a smile. You know, we beg our husband or wife didn't smile at me. I'm sad. Or my boss didn't give me a raise. I'm sad. Or my child went to college and didn't call me for 1 week and I start crying. So we get so worried. You know, I lost my, dog or my puppy died and I start crying. Or my car got wrecked and so these little problems bother us so much and we get so stressed out. And I want more money, I want more love, I want more clothes, I want bigger house, I want this and that. So those are small joys. But if you get the Lord of the universe, the Lord, when you have Him in your palm, in your hand with you, then you can acquire any wealth of the world. Not only that, but no other wealth is comparable to that. If you ask these saints, and once they have, like Mirabai, he says, Mere to Giridhar Gopal, Dusara na koi. He says, once I have the Lord of the universe, then all these tiny little pleasures, they don't chase after. You ask these saints, they willingly give up everything just to get that Lord. You look at Jesus, how he left his home and traveled for 14 years learning. Look at Buddha, look at Swami Chinmayananda, Shankaracharya, all these great saints, Mirabai. They gave up everything they had just to get the Lord of their heart. So that's why they say that is the biggest wealth. That is what you need to possess, and that is what you need to acquire, and that is what you need to chase after. I mean, yeah, we're not saying that you don't need a house and a car and, yeah, a retirement. You need certain things, but if I'm going to spend my whole life just chasing after worldly things, then my life is a waste. Get him and you'll have everything, whatever you want. In fact, once you get him, there is nothing more you will desire. Like that girl, she said, once I have the key, then, and that is what she says, Tvam asya vishvasya param nidhanam. You are the supreme wealth, the treasure house of all the wealths. Nidhana means the treasure house. Tvam avyaya, you are the immutable. Now, why do we repeat? One, we say indestructible and immutable. In our scriptures, they say repetition is a crime. Anytime you repeat an idea or a concept, it is not correct. So why are they using two different words to describe the Lord, which seem alike, indestructible? Actually, there is a substantial difference. Now, indestructible is like mud. Now, mud, as we said, you make a pot, and you break the pot, nothing happens to the mud. But the mud gets modified, right? The mud was flat, brown, and then you make it into a pot shape, and then you color it, and then you harden it. And so the mud gets modified into the pot, and when the pot breaks, the mud again goes back to its brown mud form. So it is indestructible, but it is not immutable. Immutable means cannot change, cannot be modified. So actually, in fact, the Lord is immutable. He cannot be changed. He cannot be modified. But then you say the whole universe came from Him, and He is the support of the universe, and everything originated from the Lord, and everything is changing. We are changing. We were children, and then you become an adult, and then you get old, and then you die. And this building was not there, a few years back, it has come up, and then maybe in 20, 30 years, it may be broken and a different building may be here. Everything is changing. So how can you say the Lord is immutable when the world originates from Him and it is a changing world? Yeah, the Lord is permanent. That everybody accepts. Okay, God was there forever before the world came. Even the Bible says that. But how can you say it is immutable? They say it's a concept which is a little difficult to grasp. They say the world was not really substantially created. It is an illusion. It is a projection upon the Lord. We say, I can't believe it. The table is real. I am real. This world is real. My sorrows are real. And, my problems are real. How can you say the world is? We say the world has a relative reality. It has a temporary appearance, but is not really what we think it is. And that concept, at least when I heard it, for me also was difficult. Even now I have problems, fully grasping it, but I'll just tell you what Shankaracharya and all the other great sages say. They say the world is actually a projection upon the Lord. The example, of course, they give of the rope and the snake. Some of you have heard it, but there are some new people. So I'll just briefly tell this example where there is a path. Say you are walking on a village path and on a dirt road, and it's twilight. It's neither daytime nor nighttime. It is where the time is just changing. It's not fully dark, and it's not the bright sun. And what happens is somebody has left a rope on the road, and you approach the rope, and not seeing the rope clearly because it is a very hazy, you know, it's twilight, you think there is a snake. Now, there actually is a rope, but not knowing the rope as a rope, you see a snake. And then what happens? Immediately you get scared. You know, you start sweating, your blood pressure goes up, and your pulse goes up. And if you accidentally step on it, you think, oh my God, the snake bit me. And you might even faint. And so the not seeing the rope as a rope, you project the snake on it. It is a mental projection. It's not truly a snake, but I project the snake because of my ignorance. And then the wise man comes and shines a flashlight and says, why are you so afraid? It's nothing but a rope. And the moment he does that, my illusion disappeared. He said, oh my God, what a fool I was. But until I knew that, I had all the fears that this is a poisonous snake, it is a cobra, it might bite me, I might die. So similarly, they say that this world actually is just that one consciousness. But just as the snake was projected in my mind, there was truly no snake. Similarly, this whole universe is a mental projection. In the mind of the Lord, we are all going on and for doing our activities. And it is a mental projection where everything is happening, but it's like a play. Just as in a movie, you know, you have the screen. Now, the screen remains the same. Nothing happens to the screen. On the screen, you may have a movie with blood on it, you know, people getting killed. And then the next day, there might be a movie with fire and there is smoke. And the third day, there may be a movie with flood and there's water. So even though there is water in the movie, even though there is a fire in the movie, even though there is blood in that movie, but that screen remains white, remains unchanged, is immutable. Now, the screen is necessary for the movie to be projected. If there was no screen, we would not have a place to show the movie. And the movie, even though it's not real, but the way they move it so fast, you know, the 16 frames per second or whatever, that it looks like there is a continuous movie where the hero is walking to the heroine and you know, and the villain is coming. But actually, they are separate frames that are moved so fast, it gives the appearance. So it is an illusion. So the illusion of the movie is projected upon the screen. But you and I, when we go to watch the movie, we get so caught up in it. We say, oh, the poor heroine is suffering. And then the women start crying and tears start running down their cheeks. And then, you know, and then the young kids get excited because the hero is beating up the villain. And they also start, you know, punching the seat. So we get so engrossed in the movie that we forget that it's not really a real movie, especially like in these soap operas, you know, which go on for years. And these people get so engrossed. Oh my God, that person is so terrible. Look at how he's mistreating the heroine. And they get all so, and they're waiting for the next episode and when that villain can be punished, and they're waiting for the hero to arrive. So even though that movie is not real, but we project reality upon it. So similarly, they say this world has a relative reality. It is a temporary appearance. We are not saying that the world is not true, but it is a temporary projection upon the Lord, and it is a changing reality. It's not permanent, right? Everything is changing. The table is changing. I am changing. We are all changing. But the one constant is the Lord, who is the support and the substratum of this changing world. So what we say that the one permanent reality is the Lord. You can call him Krishna, you can call him Jesus, you can call him Allah, Father in heaven. But that one reality is constant, and we are all a temporary projection or appearance upon the Lord. And that is what we have to focus on. See, we focus so much upon my body, you know, oh, I am the body, and my body is suffering, I am suffering, or I am the mind and my emotions, and I'm a very emotional person, I'm such a loving and sympathetic, and then when somebody doesn't appreciate me, then I get sorrowful, or, you know, I am the greatest, you know, writer, or I'm a great doctor, or I'm a great teacher, and then when people don't appreciate, I get sorrowful, because we identify with the body, the mind, and the intellect. But the scriptures tell us that we are all that consciousness. We are all a manifestation of that divinity. And we are all actually Brahman. We are all actually that consciousness playing the part of whatever, Surendra or Anil or Hansa or whatever role we have been given, Diana, whatever part, name I have been given, I am playing that part and I am really that consciousness. So they say, focus your attention always on that consciousness. And let whatever happen to the body, yes, things will happen to the body. If I get sick, I go take care of the medicine, but I don't get myself all stressed out. If my mind goes through joys and sorrows, I say, I am that consciousness. Yes, my mind today is happy. Tomorrow my mind may be unhappy, but I am not involved. Or same way, if I have success and failure, does not mean that you don't take care of the body or you don't work hard, or you don't try to have joys, but life is not going to always give us good things. So if you identify with that consciousness and say, I am that consciousness, let there be heat and cold, joy and sorrow, success and failure, it does not affect me. So that is the meaning of immutable, that the Lord is that immutable substratum on which this whole play of this world is going on. Just as on the stage, the play is going on and actors are coming and playing their part and going, but the stage remains unaffected. So that's why they say that this world is a projection upon that consciousness. It's a little difficult concept, but the more you think about it, and especially in meditation when we try to identify with that consciousness, then you get glimpses of that joy and that bliss and that energy, and then you kind of can at times get feelings that this world is not really as real as we think it is. And so that is what the teachers tell us, that meditate and practice, apply that. Then it says, you are the protector of the eternal dharma. Now dharma is a word which has many meanings. Actually, if you look in the Sanskrit dictionary, you look dharma, you'll get 2 pages of meanings. It's probably 100 different meanings or maybe even more. The word dharma here, what he's talking about, the eternal dharma is the eternal dharma, the permanent. But dharma in our vernacular has many meanings. One is dharma is Hindu dharma. You know, they say, oh, Hindu, oh, Hindu dharam ka hai, Isai dharam ka hai. Islam, that means the religion, that he belongs to the Hindu faith or the Muslim faith or the Christian faith. Then dharma is also translated as duty. You know, ye mera dharma hai, because this is my duty, I have to do it. As a doctor, this is my duty. As a teacher, this is my duty. As a mother, this is my duty. Then dharma also can be translated as your station in life. Like, you know, they say that there are 4 dharmas. So brahmacharya, like there is a youth phase, you know, in our life. They have divided the human life into 100 years. I mean, not everybody lives 100 years, but for understanding that the first 25 years are called brahmacharya dharma or the brahmacharya ashram. That means the childhood or the youth. So the first 25 years, I'm a student, and what is my dharma? It is to study. So they say brahmachari ka dharma hai padna. So first 25 years, I study. Then next 25 to 50 years, I am supposed to work and take care of my family and take care of my children, take care of, educate them well, take care of my old parents. You know, that is also my dharma. That is also my duty. And in general, acquire, you know, some degree of wealth and home and all that. And then they say 50 to 75 years, you should start withdrawing from the world. Slowly you start detaching yourself And once your children are educated and have done with their college and all, then, you know, leave them free. They're doing their job. Don't hold on to them. Don't stick to them and don't start crying about them. You know, now my job is to know God. So the 50 to 75 years, you slowly turn your attention away from the world of objects, emotions, and thoughts, and turn your attention to God. So you slowly withdraw. So your dharma is called Varnash, it is called, what is the, Vanaprastha ashram, where you are slowly withdrawing your attention from the world to the Lord. And then, of course, after 75, if you live, they say sannyas, where you give up everything and you become a whole-time seeker of the Lord. So the dharma of the student is to study, the dharma of the grahastha is to take care of the family, and then so on, where all these different vanaprastha and sannyas. So dharma can be translated as my station in life, what is my duty. Dharma also sometimes is used as rules of conduct, you know, how one should live, like they have this Manu Smriti and all, or like the Ten Commandments, where they say you should do this, you should not do this. So talking about doing and not doing and the rules of conduct, there was this man who was speeding on the highway, he was driving a little fast. So this police car started following him and started flashing the lights. And the man saw the lights in his rearview mirror. Normally we slowed down, but he sped up even faster. So the police said, what's the matter? So he started with his siren and chasing him and driving faster, 90, 100. Finally, the police car drove so fast, it overtook him and kind of stopped him to one side. And then police came and, you know, he didn't look like a criminal. He looked like a decent guy, so... He says, why were you speeding? You know, didn't you see my lights? He says, yeah. He says, why didn't you stop? He says, well, it's like this. Last month, my wife ran off with the cop, and I thought you were bringing her back. She ran off with the policeman. I thought you were bringing her back. So anyway, so dharma is also translated as code of conduct, as the how one should behave in life, what one should do. But here, the meaning of the eternal dharma is that dharma is my essential nature. I am that. Just as what is the dharma of sugar? The dharma of sugar is sweetness. If it's not sweet, it's not sugar. Like in India, we get this patkadi, alam, which looks like sugar. It's perfectly like sugar, you know, like sugar in the particles. But when you bite into it, it is bitter. So if it is not sweet, we don't call it sugar. So what is the dharma of sugar? Sweetness. Now what is the dharma of fire? Fire has to have heat and light. If there is no heat and light, we don't call it fire. So similarly, what is my dharma? What is my essential nature? And what is the essential nature of all of us? Not only of all the humans, of all the plants, of all the birds, all the fish, even all the rocks and stones. The essential nature is that. That is who I really, really am. Underneath, when you go to all the through all the layers, that is who I really am. So he says that you are the one who is the eternal Sanatan Dharma. You are our essential nature. That is what you really are. And that's why the Hindu dharma is called the Sanatan Dharma. The name came later on because of the Indus River. You know, when the Muslims and the Greeks came across the Indus River, they called them Sindhu. It was called the Sindhu River, and that's how the name Hindu came. But in fact, the true name is Sanatan Dharma, means which is the ancient religion. The idea being that these religious ideas are eternal. Even though, yeah, they can say, okay, Christianity, the idea started with Jesus, or Islam started with Muhammad. But the ideas that were given by Christ or Muhammad or Krishna or Shankaracharya are eternal. And that's why he says, you, the Lord, are the protector. You are the support of the eternal Dharma. And then he says, Sanatanas, you are the Sanatan. You are the eternal that we have already talked about. And you are the spirit. You are the life principle, Purusha. Purusha means the spirit or the life principle. Because this universe is divided into two, Purush and Prakriti. So Purush means the spirit and prakriti means the matter. And we are all a combination of both. If we were only a combination of matter, the body, mind, and intellect, but if the spirit was not there, we would not be able to, we would be dead, we would not be able to function. But say if the spirit alone is there, and there is no body, mind, and intellect, then the spirit cannot function in the world. So the spirit needs the body, mind, and intellect to function. So Purush needs Prakriti. That's why they say this whole universe is a marriage between Purush and Prakriti, between the spirit and matter. So he says, you are the eternal spirit. But then what is the relationship of the spirit to matter? What is the relationship of Prakriti with Purush? And are they connected? And if we are all that eternal spirit, then why are some people good, some people bad? Is the spirit in them contaminated? You know, they say, that is a terrible person. He is a criminal. And then they say, that is a saint. And then that is... What is the spirit getting contaminated? Is the spirit becoming bad? Or is it the person who is bad? There is a very beautiful shloka in the Upanishads which talks about what is the relationship between the spirit and matter, Prakriti and Purush. The spirit is equated to a sphatika. Sphatika is a pure crystal, which is pure uncontaminated crystal. If you have a large crystal, you know, which is totally uncontaminated, colorless, shining, beautiful crystal, and that is sphatika. That is the Sanskrit name. And so the spirit is called sphatika. It is called that. Even in the Shiva Stotram, they said, Shuddha Sphatika Sankasham Trinetram Panchavaktrakam. So that is the pure sphatika, the pure crystal. But then what is the relationship of this crystal, the Lord, to the rest of the universe? They say, Shuddhatma Nila Vastradi Yogena Sphatiko Yathaha. So sphatika, so the crystal. Now the crystal is colorless, is pure, it's uncontaminated, it is beautiful. But suppose you put it on a blue cloth. I put the crystal on a blue cloth. What happens? The crystal becomes blue. Appears blue. In fact, there is no change. The crystal is still blue, is still colorless, still beautiful, clean, white, but appears blue. Now you put it on a red cloth, it will appear red. The crystal will appear red. You put it on a dirty, muddy, horrible, ugly cloth, which is full of dirt, and the crystal, even though it's pure, shining, will look dirty, muddy, contaminated. So it says the crystal, nothing happens to the crystal, but depending on the color of the cloth, the crystal appears different. It lends itself. It has no qualities of its own. But depending on what it comes in contact with, the crystal takes that quality. So similarly, the consciousness within us is uncontaminated. Panch koshadi yogena tat tanmaya ivasthitaha shuddhatma. It is called the shuddhatma. It is the pure spirit. But it comes in contact with five sheets or five coverings, which is called the panch kosha, the five sheets. Just as a sword, in the olden days, people used to carry sword. They wouldn't have the sword, you know, free because it could cut anybody. So they would put it in a sheath and put it on the side. And then when it was time to fight, they would pull it out and, you know, fight with people. But all the time it was kept covered in the sheath so that it should not hurt anybody. So similarly, this consciousness appears to be covered by the five sheets. In reality, the consciousness is everywhere. But in me, I say, you know, I am the body, and then in me I have a mind, and then I have an intellect, and then I have desires. And inside tiny is one little consciousness that is not true, but that is what we think. So they say that this consciousness is covered by five sheets, apparently covered. In reality, it cannot be covered. Just as, you know, it's a cloudy day, and you say the sun is covered by the cloud. Now that cloud is tiny, you know, 2 miles in diameter, and the sun is millions of miles, you know, of in size, and so much light. All is the whole universe is being illumined by that sun, the entire solar system. But 1 2-mile of cloud, can it block the sun? No, it cannot. But in my vision, because the cloud appears in front of me, so I say the sun is blocked. even though in Africa it may be shining, it may be shining in India, everywhere. So I say the sun is covered by the clouds. So similarly, we do not see the consciousness because we are so focused on the coverings. So they say there are five coverings that cover this consciousness. The reason I'm doing it, because this is an important concept for us to understand. So they say one is the Annamaya Kosha, or the food sheath, because this body is made of food. I eat the food and then it makes the body. The mother eats the food and that nourishes the fetus. So the body is made out of food. It's called the Annamaya. Then there is a Pranamaya Kosha, or the physiological functions, which are subtler than the body, like the digestive system and the respiratory system and the air I am breathing and the circulatory system and the ability to, it's not the pumping heart, but the ability to circulate, the ability to breathe is called the Pranamaya Kosha. Then the third sheath is the mind, or the Manomaya Kosha, which is the seat of emotions. And then the fourth one is the intellect, or called the Vijnanamaya Kosha, which is the intellect. And the fifth sheath is the Anandamaya Kosha, the bliss sheath, or the vasanas. So these sheaths, the body, the pranas, the mind, the intellect, and the vasanas, apparently cover the spirit. The spirit, in fact, is never covered. It is all the time unaffected. So it says, you are that eternal Purusha. You are that eternal spirit whom at this moment we are covered by these five sheets. So they say, shift your attention. Again and again, they keep on telling us that shift your attention from the body, the mind, the intellect. And even when you're continuing your activities, when you're walking on the treadmill, you say, I am that consciousness who at this moment is walking on the treadmill. And you can then watch your body. And even that treadmill can become a meditative activity, or whatever activity I'm doing. I'm driving, I'm working in the office, I'm cooking. If you shift your attention to the consciousness and you say, I am that consciousness who at this moment is doing the dishes, then that becomes a spiritual activity. So he says that is the eternal Purush. And then that Purusha, that spirit is eternal. Nothing happens to that. It's the body that is changing, the emotions, the thoughts, and the desires. Sorry, it was a little long talk, but this verse is important, so I thought I'd spend some time. Anybody has any questions or comments? Yes. What happened was God was alone. So, and he had this ability to create, just as an artist is sitting there and he watches a beautiful sunrise. Now, you and I don't have the ability, but he has the ability to paint. So he takes out a paintbrush and easel and makes a beautiful picture of the sunrise. He doesn't do it to earn money, or, you know, he might suck. It's the joy he's expressing. Oh, this beautiful sunrise. And he paints it. Or a poet writing a beautiful poetry. He has this thought come in his mind, you know, this beautiful poem. And he does it just out. Not that the poem should be published and I should be recognized, out of joy. And then later on, yeah, okay, if it gets published and gets sold, the book of poetry, that's okay. So similarly, the Lord had this ability to create. And so what he did was, out of joy, he expressed his ability to create and created this beautiful world. And the world is perfect. You know, that's what they say, like Garden of Eden was perfect. And everything was going fine. And then he then created man and woman as the highest form of creation. Man is the highest form of creation. We have an intellect. We have the ability to think. And it says that he got extreme joy that this is the best creation I have created. It's not that he's getting joy from us. He's just expressing his ability to create. And in one place in the Upanishads, it says he even, you know, danced. He became so happy because man is such a intelligent creature. We can do anything. You know, we can go to the space, we can go to the bottom of the earth, we can discover even the atom. And the biggest ability that man has is we can recognize God and we can realize God. We can become one with him, which the animals cannot. No matter how, if you put an animal in a temple and lock him up for 100 years or until he dies, he's not going to realize the truth. So that is the ability. So that's what the Lord did. He created this beautiful Garden of Eden and then put Adam and Eve in it. But the but the mistake he made, I wouldn't call it a mistake, but whatever, he gave us the ability to think and to reason, and gave us the choice, which he did not give. A plant doesn't have a choice. It will grow straight. A cat doesn't have a choice. A lion doesn't have a choice. Lion will attack the deer and kill it. So humans were given the choice that, okay, you have the choice to make your life good or bad. You can make your life heaven or hell. And so whatever the problems we see are man-made. They are not God-created. They are man-made problems. And why people are suffering? Because of their own actions. And it is, as we know, it's not only actions in this life, but actions in multiple lifetimes that we are carrying, which is the seed of our vasanas. So that's how the world came into that's what I have read, that it was created just out of joy. Beautiful world was created, which was perfect. If you remove man and woman, this world is perfect. There's nothing wrong with the world. We have the ability to make the world beautiful, or we can make it ugly. You know, we have beautified this world. We have made nice buildings, and we have made, you know, planes and cars and ability to travel. And we have, you know, science we have discovered. So man has done a lot of good things. It's not everything we have done is bad. But at the same time, we have made nuclear bombs and, you know, missiles and everything. So that is how the world came into existence. But it is still an illusion. It is a dream. It is not. It has a relative reality. We're not saying it is unreal. It is a relative reality. It is a changing reality. When we say something is real, then what we mean is it was there in the past, in the present, and the future, and will always remain the same. That which is changing has a relative reality, and that is us. That's why we say this world is a projection upon the Lord. But I think the more you focus on the reality, like if you go back, you remember when you were 5 years old, what you did, right? Your first day in school or whatever, your first dress or your first birthday event that you remember. And then you remember your youth and you remember your foolishness and all. So we remember all those things. So the one that is remembering, focus on that. Who is the one that was there when I was 5 years old, is there now and will be there even when I become old and after I'm gone? So the more you focus on that, at least I have not had that final experience, but the saints who have experienced that, then they say this world gets a hazy appearance. Then the world is not that important for them anymore. They still function in the world, but mostly the saints function in the world out of compassion for us. See, a realized master like Swami Chinmayananda, he was sitting with his guru in the Himalayas, and he had already realized the truth, and he told his guru, I want to go down to the plains because the people in India and then, of course, people in the world do not have this knowledge. I want to share this knowledge with them. The guru said, you don't need to go. You are sitting here. You are fine. If somebody wants this knowledge, let him come to you. That's what his guru used to do. His guru stayed in the Himalayas. He never went anywhere. And good, sincere seekers would go to the guru and learn from him. Because he was of a different temperament. He was very quiet, very peaceful, Tapovan Maharaj. We have his picture on the left side in the hall. And he just stayed in his little heart and he was totally content. But Swami Chinmayananda was a more dynamic individual. So he said, this knowledge that I have acquired of the Upanishads and Gita, I want to share it with the people. Early in the 1949-50, people didn't have translations of the Bhagavad Gita. There were no commentaries. And so out of compassion, he's traveled through the whole length of India and then throughout the world for the next 43 years till he left his body out of compassion. So the saints, once they have realized the truth, they then work for us. They don't need to work. They do not get anything additional because they have acquired the highest. So whatever they do, once Jesus had understood that truth, whatever time he spent in preaching, it was for the people, not for that he would get any glory or any extra joy or anything like that. So the more you focus on that consciousness, ultimately, the goal of every human being is to realize that. Then you will give less importance to the world. And it already happens. You know, as you slowly turn your mind on the spiritual path, your desire for shopping will go down. You know, your desire for, if somebody invited me to, in the olden days, if somebody didn't invite us to a party on Friday, oh, I feel so depressed. Oh, my God. And I'm, after a while, you say, nahin bulaya to achha hai. You know, they didn't call me, I'm fine. I'll sit home and, you know, just read or do something for. So slowly you get less, you give less importance to the worldly things as you evolve spiritually. And, of course, these saints, they give up everything and they put on orange clothes. Or put on the white clothes and spend their whole life in pursuit of the Lord. Sorry, long answer to your short question. Right, well, you know, any leaf cannot move, that's true. But humans were given the freedom to choose, like Adam and Eve and their children. Already one son, Abel murdered Cain or somebody. So right from the first parents, their children, one of them murdered the other. Forget about us. So the point is that God gave freedom to humans to choose. And in that process, he said, you can become a saint or you can become a criminal. So he gave us the freedom. And at the same time, he gave us the knowledge. See, he gave us the knowledge through the Gita and the Bible and all those scriptures. He gave us the right knowledge, but our problem is we don't follow it. Then he gave us an intellect to choose right from wrong. You know, we all know when we are doing the wrong thing, when a thief is stealing, he doesn't do it in the open daylight. You know, when will he steal? In the middle of the night, because he knows it is wrong, or when nobody is watching. So he gave us the intellect to decide. He gave us the scriptures to guide us. But if we still don't do it, then we suffer the consequences. In a way it is, but there is a power called Maya. There is a power of God called Maya, which he hides behind that power. Even though it is, we are all his creation. But then he created this power, which is like a game, like a play. You know, like it's just a game he's playing. And then in that, and he created Maya so that we don't see God. We don't experience him, even though we are his manifestation. But we are separated from him because of this power of vasanas. And the total subtotal of all the vasanas is called Maya. So Maya is the power of the Lord which separates him from us. But in reality, the Maya can be easily overcome if you want it. But our problem is we don't want God. So Swamiji says, you know, he said last week, he says, by the way, you know, if I side my realization, mil gayi. By the way, if I get realization, it's okay. But my goal is to acquire more money, wealth, power, blah, blah, blah. And along the way, if realization comes, I'll just take it, you know, if we're standing on the roadside. So for us, God realization is just one of the, you know, small goals in life. It's not the main goal. So when that happens, it is very easy to overcome Maya. In the Bhagavad Gita, it says the same thing. Mameva ye prapadyante maya metam tarantite. He says, one who want me and me alone, for them to cross Maya is very easy. Devi hyesha gunamayi mama maya durateya. My Maya is very difficult to cross. But one who wants me, the Lord says, it is very easy for him. These saints had no problem because they made him the number one goal of life. Right. In the ninth chapter, he says, they are in me, I am not in them. In fact, they are not in me at all. Pashyame yogam aishwaram. So the way to illustrate, that's a very difficult concept. It needs a lot of explanation. But in brief, to explain that, he says like the waves. The ocean says, waves are in me, I am not in them. Right? The ocean will say, waves are in me, I am not in them. In fact, I am not in the waves at all. And the waves are not in me. So that's the second part we don't understand. So the first part is the waves are in me, but I am not in them. That we can understand. Okay, waves are in the ocean. The waves are born and the waves die. But nothing happens to the ocean. Does the ocean change? No, ocean doesn't change. Oh, there are 1,000 waves being born. Oh, the ocean is happy. But then there are 1,000 waves dying. You know, ocean doesn't become unhappy. Just as we say, you know, people are being born and God should be happy, and people are being died, God should be unhappy. No, it's happening constantly. million, lot more are being born these days. So the God says, you know, there's too much population explosion. They've reached 7 billion. There's not enough food and water. But anyway, so the people are being born constantly and then people are dying. So this is a cycle that is going on. So the waves are being born. The waves are in the ocean, but the ocean is not in the waves, right? Whether the waves are born or waves are died, nothing happens to the ocean. The ocean remains the same, right? That is the first part. They are in me, I am not in them. And then he says, but in fact, they are not in me at all. And I am not in, they are not in me at all because when it looks from the point of view of water, when you look at water, there is no wave. Wave is just an appearance. In reality, there is no change. At least the ocean, you can say, got changed. Okay, ocean got modified. You know, it became modified. But when you look at water, there is only one. There is no wave. There is no ocean. There is nothing but that one water appearing as different forms. So even that distinction between the waves and the ocean disappears when you focus on that water. So that's what he says. I am that reality in me. Everything is happening. In fact, I am not involved. The Lord says, even though everything is happening in me, I am not involved. I don't become happy when somebody is happy. I don't become sad when somebody becomes sad because I am that, the spirit that nourishes. What becomes happy and unhappy is the mind or the intellect or the body, you know, but the consciousness. So he says, that's why he says, they are in me, I am not in them. Actually, if you go to the website, firstpower.info, I think Tony puts them. And if you look at the ninth chapter, a couple of years back. So you will find this particular verse at that time, about 2 years ago. So if you go to firstpower.info, that's the website, and then you go to Bhagavad Gita by Anil Mehta. I think I'd like to thank Tony if he puts them on. But if you find that particular verse in the Bhagavad Gita, it's the second or third verse. Fourth verse. So if you find the fourth verse, I don't remember where verses. I remember where what is. But so he says in the fourth and fifth verse, if you look in the ninth chapter, you will find a detailed explanation, which I did about 2 years ago. I hope it's correct. But I do use Swami Chinmayananda's commentary and then some other commentaries to do that. So look it up there. You'll find it. I had taken almost a whole hour to talk about that. Right, and that's true. Thank you. That's a very good point. Excellent point. Because the wave, if it thinks itself to be the wave, then it will be suffering. Oh, the wave is rising and the wave is falling. I'm getting higher and I'm getting lower. And then it suffers. But if the wave says, I am the water, thank you. That's a very good point. Then whether the wave rises or falls, you know, nothing happens to me. So similarly, if I say, I am the consciousness, then tomorrow, even if I have to give up this body and I say, it's okay. I gave up the body. But I am the consciousness. So changes at the physical, mental or intellectual level will not affect me. But if I say I am the body, then definitely as my body gets older, as I get wrinkles, then I'll be sorry. And then I'll go get plastic surgery and then try to delay, you know. But ultimately everybody gets old. So same way mentally somebody insults me, somebody doesn't love me. So I will go through these, but if I identify myself with the body, yes, I will suffer. But if I say I am the consciousness, then I gracefully age. Then I say it's okay. You know, body is getting old. One day I have to give it up. If the arthritis pain comes, I take some Tylenol or some Advil, but I don't, you know, get depressed about it. Okay, it's nature of the joint. The knee will hurt, you know, once I get to be a certain age. So I just take the medicine, go to see one of the internists sitting back there and they'll give you some good medicine and then you get well. But you don't get stressed about it. That is the difference, you know, between a wise person. Yes. Absolutely. Right. You identify with the name and form or you identify, like Hansa said, you identify with the water or with the wave. You identify with the spirit or with matter. So Prakriti and Purush, you have to constantly focus on the spirit. And let the matter take care of itself. Matter does not matter. That's what. Yes. No, if truly if he's mentally retarded or challenged, then he's not a realized person. He is suffering from some previous birth. He might have done some deeds, because of which he's born in that particular body, which is almost like an animal-like body, you know. And so he has to go through that suffering of this particular body, and then in his next birth, then he can continue his spiritual journey. Right, right. And it's our own, like a dog or a cat, so they don't have an ability to. So I think same way, I'm not trying to belittle them, but you have to actually feel sorry or compassionate towards people who are suffering. But why they are going through is because of that. And our job is, if there is somebody like that, we have to help him. And that is how we evolve. If somebody who is suffering and somebody who is miserable, instead of saying, he's suffering because of his karmas, let him suffer. If I have the ability to help, if there is a home for the mentally challenged where I can go help, or there is somebody, and if I can help, then I should help those people. Somebody suffering from leprosy or blindness or, you know, whatever. So if I have the ability and the financial resources to serve the world, I must. But at the same time, I must have sympathy and compassion for that individual. But the idea is that the goal of human birth is to realize. The goal of human birth is not to have more children, not to have more money, bigger house. The goal is to realize. And while I am doing my duties, I should always keep my attention on that Lord. And that is what I have to reach.
That would reduce the suffering.
Yes, reduce the suffering and bring you closer to the truth. And ultimately, we have to go there. If not this time, you have to go in next life or 10 lifetimes from now. So why not start from this life? Why not start from today, that today I'm going to make this my spiritual journey? Once we have the right knowledge from the Lord himself, then we have to start applying it. Then only the knowledge is fruitful. Yeah, yes. True, yeah, mentally he is not aware that he is suffering. Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, that he may not know that I am suffering. Yeah, which is true. Yeah, but again, unless we are in that person's body, it's very hard to judge. So the way I look at it is that, you know, it's you know, we always talk about that person or this person. Ultimately, this spirituality is for me. You know, what am I doing with it? You know, and we worry about, why did God create the world? Why is there so much suffering? Why is there so many problems? It's his world. Let him worry about it. Tera hai, teri dunya, tu sambhal. What I am concerned about is me. And I am here for, so what am I going to do with my life? After having read the scriptures, after having learned from teacher like Swami Chinmayananda and all the Jesus and all, if I don't change my life, then my reading is useless. So ultimately, this book is a mirror where I look at myself and say, you know, do I fit all these qualities or not? And that is, you know, and the goal is to become divine. And that is what, you know, and am I making myself divine? And they say life is a journey, you know, it's like, it's lifetimes of journey. But ultimately, the journey has to end in the Lord. So let me start and let me get inspiration from these saints and from these great teachers and evolve towards sainthood, towards Godhood. So that is so ultimately, you feel sympathy and compassion for those who are suffering, and if you try to relieve their suffering, but the main purpose of spirituality is to evolve. And as you evolve, the compassion for others becomes spontaneous. You don't have to put an effort. Like Jesus, he didn't have to, you know, put an effort. Spontaneously, the compassion flowed when he saw somebody, you know, blind, he, you know, healed them, and the sick and all that. Look at all these saints, you know, they spontaneously share their love with the world. So they don't, for you and me, we have to put an extra effort. Oh, this person is suffering. The Gita says, I must help him, so I may do it. But for them, they don't need a Bhagavad Gita to tell them, because it comes to them spontaneously. So the oneness comes spontaneously, because you see that the divinity in me is the divinity in all. So they are all me. So that is realization, when you see the oneness. Om Sarve Bhavantu Sukhinaha, Sarve Santu Niramayaha, Sarve Bhadrani Pashyantu, Ma Kashchit Dukkha Bhag Bhavet. Om Shanti Shanti Shantihi, Hari Om Shri Gurubhyo Namah. Hari Om.